Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
On the 8th of August of 2023, Naivi Turia woke up in his home in Lahaina on the Hawaiian island of Maui. He got up, got dressed, and went to work as a chef at a popular seafood restaurant that was visited by tourists from all over the world.
The day of August 8th, power was on and off, as I recall. Like, I remember the night before power going out, so I'm already thinking in my head, I gotta go to the restaurant as early as I can in the morning.
His restaurant sat on Front Street, a main strip of restaurants, galleries, and shops that runs along the oceanfront in the historic Lahaina town. He and his team went through their power outage protocol of saving food, and then made a plan to return to the restaurant at 5 p.m. to open to customers.
And that never happened. But at the same time, we never knew what was going on.
And at that time, when you left the restaurant, how windy was it?
Oh, it was extremely windy. My truck was moving from the wind. We were watching all these buildings around us, like, just start kind of falling apart. You know, the shingles were coming off the roofs.
On that day, wind speeds of up to 80 miles per hour were recorded, and the temperature peaked at 33 degrees Celsius, about 91 degrees Fahrenheit. As Naivi battled the wind on his short drive home, his sense that something wasn't right started to grow. He noticed there weren't any other cars on the road. These roads were usually packed with locals and tourists in rental vehicles.
It was weird just not seeing cars, and it was weird seeing just rubbish everywhere and debris just flying. And when I got home around 3:30, I noticed there was smoke coming from the mountainside, and the smoke was white colored. So in my head, I'm thinking, okay, this is a very fresh fire.
What he saw were the first signs of a fire that had started at approximately 2:55 p.m. that day. But this fire didn't seem too close. It was up on the hillside above the town. And Lahaina residents aren't strangers to fire. It's a dry and hot place full of invasive grasses. And when small fires start in those open fields, they're usually contained quickly. So Naivi decided to take a shower after work before reassessing the situation on the hill.
And when I got out, I felt like it was sunset all of a sudden because how dark it got. And then my dad and I are just like looking at each other like, what do we do? And I eventually left the apartment and I told my dad that I was going to come back home to let him know where this fire is, because we don't know the direction. Like, we don't know exactly where the fire is. And I got like a block away from the house, and that was it. I couldn't even go back where I came. It was pitch black. There was all these embers and all these just bright orange glowing all around me. It felt like a movie. It felt like I was in a war zone. It was the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life.
In the U.S. state of Hawaii, firefighters are still trying to get the fires under control.
Within hours, that small hillside fire grew to an unmanageable size. It caught onto grasses and nearby homes, and aided by the high Kaua'ula winds, the fire swept through the town of Lahaina.
Reports say some people jumped into the ocean to escape the flames.
It would take days for the fire to be completely contained. The blaze ripped through 2,200 structures, 96% of which were residential. It left over 6,000 people homeless, destroyed significant historical Hawaiian sites, and took the lives of 101 people.
What you're seeing now is drone footage from the all but destroyed town of Lahaina. As you can see, structures are completely leveled, trees stripped, and the devastation is reaching all the way to the shoreline.
It is the deadliest natural disaster in the state's history and one of the deadliest wildfires on American record. I was born and raised on the island of Maui. But 8 years ago, I moved to London. As I watched this tragedy unfold from my home in the UK, I was in utter disbelief. In the weeks and months following, everyone wanted to know who or what was to blame for this disaster. But as I obsessively refreshed news site after news site, it felt like an incredibly important piece of the puzzle was missing. Lahaina did not go from being the lush and green capital of Hawaii it once was to a place capable of disappearing in flames overnight. That process took hundreds of years.
What happened in Lahaina is a culmination of bad decisions in West Maui. And if people did not see this coming, I don't know what to say.
In this program, I'm going back home to Maui, and I'm teaming up with a longtime family friend, Hokulani Holt, to help me uncover this story. She is a hula teacher, culture practitioner, and one of the most respected global voices in preserving Hawaiian culture. You'll hear me refer to her as Kumuhoku, the culturally respectful way to refer to a teacher in Hawaii. Together, we want to find out what changes to Hawaiian land, culture, and water could have contributed to the devastation of the wildfire on August 8th. And we'll find out a year later if anything has changed.
Do you think this has made anyone wake up?
Oh, big time. I think everybody is waking up now.
Aloha. From the BBC World Service, this is Hokulani Holt.
And I'm Pulama Kaufman. And this is the documentary, Under Ash, Uncovering Maui's Hidden Past.
This is where they're dumping.
Okay.
And that goes on 24/7 up there.
It's April 2024. It's been 8 months since the fire destroyed Lahaina, and my mom, Meryl, is driving me to see for myself what is left. Lahaina is a small town on the west side of the Hawaiian island of Maui. Only one road connects the town to the rest of the island. Its seclusion means that it has a tight-knit community, a deep sense of culture, and its beauty attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists every year. I'm not from Lahaina. I grew up on the south side of Maui, but my late father, Greg Kaufman, led a nonprofit whose main business was running whale watches and snorkel trips. And many of these boats left from the Lahaina Harbor. Growing up, I spent a lot of time on the ocean looking back at the view of Lahaina. I remember the harbor, full to the brim with catamarans and sailboats, the surfers sitting on their boards waiting for the next break, the palm trees extended to the sky, swaying in the wind, and the dramatic backdrop of the West Maui Mountains, the tops nearly always shrouded in clouds. I haven't been home for 3 years, and the last time I was here, that was still Lahaina, a bustling tourist epicenter and home to nearly 13,000 people.
So let me just tell you, these flags, all we'll see them now from here all the way out, and besides the Hawaiian flags, they show the nationalities of the people who died, like okay. All their nationalities are represented.
On the bypass that winds down into Lahaina, we pass a Hawaiian flag, a Japanese flag, flags from the Philippines, and many, many more. I'm entering the burn zone for the first time to meet with Kumuhoku at the historic site of Moku'ula.
You want me to test?
Yeah, if you do just a little test, say maybe your name, yeah. Where we are.
Hokulani Holt. Today is April 16th. We are at Moku'ula in Lahaina, and in the background you'll be hearing the machines that are doing the cleanup of this area.
We're sitting in the shade of a palm tree in a green marshy field surrounded by overgrown bushes and grasses. Before the fires, it was a neatly mowed county park with a baseball field. It was a dry area, and the park had exposed spots of dirt and dead grass. But we're meeting here because before Moku'ula became a park in 1919, it was one of the most significant historical sites in Hawaii.
So before this was a park, what was here? You know, if we go back 200, 300 years ago.
The area, the majority of the area was a pond. It was called Mokuhinia Pond. And in the pond, there was also an island that was called Moku'ula. So if this were back then, we would be probably sitting on either the causeway or the island itself, and the waters of the pond would be surrounding us. And during the time of the monarchy that was here, which was Kamehameha III especially, he had a house built on the island, as well as a mausoleum for his mother and his sister once they passed away. So this area was the center of the Hawaiian government.
The monarchy, known to Hawaiians as the Ali'i, named Lahaina as the capital of Hawaii in 1802, and they reigned here until 1850.
Why do you think the Ali'i chose this location?
Many reasons. One, water is extremely important to the life of all people and plants, and the waters that fed into Lahaina were numerous. There were numerous rivers and waterways that came down into Lahaina, and thus living would have been easier.
There are many modern paintings of Moku'ula that try to replicate what it would have looked like based on oral histories and its archaeological footprint. If you were looking at it from the ocean, you would have seen a large pond with clean, flowing water. Sitting in the middle of the pond was a collection of small houses with thatched roofs, and surrounding Moku'ula were hundreds of ulu trees, also known as Hawaiian breadfruit. And behind this royal site, in every single depiction, the West Maui Mountains rise up, completely green. Kumuhoku and I pack up our things and take the 2-minute drive down Front Street from Moku'ula to Lahaina Harbor. We park and sit on the harbor wall. The dock is empty of boats because it's in the heart of the burn zone. I'm thinking about the waters that ran from the mountains behind us, through Moku'ula, and out to this sea. During those prosperous times, the town was not yet commonly called Lahaina. It went by the name of Lele, and people would often refer to it by the phrase Kamalu'ulu o Lele.
Kamalu'ulu o Lele means the shade of Lele that is created by the ulu plant, so the ulu shade of Lele. So that tells us that the shade trees, or the ulu, were so prevalent that they covered the area known as Lele. And from what has been written, that meant that Lahaina was much cooler because the trees are very tall. Ulu trees are very tall. And ulu trees live for a very long time. They can feed 2 generations of people. Having a place that is so full of ulu trees that they create shade in the town or in the area called Lele tells us that there was lots of food that they were able to feed their people, and they understood that the shade would also benefit the heat of the town and also the waterways.
It's hard to pin down exactly when Lele became a town, but it's easy to see why it did. The water that came here from the mountains was abundant, and in return, food crops grew here. Wherever you have water and food, you also have power. We know from oral history that by at least the 1500s, Hawaiian royalty was living in Lele. And they had a deep understanding of how important it was to protect its special environment.
Kaka'alaneo was a ruling chief of this area probably around the 1500s. And his son was a naughty boy and would often do things that he shouldn't do. And one of the things that he did do was to pull up ulu trees in Lahaina. And that was considered very, very bad. And so because he did that, he pulled up the ulu trees, which would feed the people here, his father banished him to Lana'i. And at that time, Lana'i was seen as a place where ghosts lived. And so him being banished to Lana'i was an indication to the people that if you do something like pulling up plants and food trees, it's bad enough for you to be banished away from your homeland. And so it's a lesson to us about how they viewed ulu and the rest of the food plants. It was considered also an act of war. If a chief came and destroyed food plants, it would be considered an act of war. So these things indicate to us how important the food plants were to our people.
As we get up to leave, I turn from my view of the harbor to the town behind me. I can see the old courthouse, with its burnt and collapsed-in roof, streets filled with rubble and burned-out cars, and the large banyan tree, with its charred branches, just starting to bloom again. And in front of me, on a stone plinth, is a tourist information sign that reads, "Lahaina was known as the Venice of the Pacific."
When you look at Lahaina, and the assumption is Lahaina is hot, and it's like, how could water, you know, be flowing in the area and sustain all these massive lo'i kalo? Lahaina, Kaua'ula was considered a really large stream. Just this extensive lo'i kalo field system from the depths of that valley all the way down to the kai. When you look at that stream today, you have to scratch your head and wonder, how did that happen?
That's Hokuau Pellegrino. He specializes in preserving cultural plants and agriculture, and he's been fighting for water rights for Hawaiians for over 20 years. When he speaks about lo'i kalo, he's referring to the large taro patches that used to dominate the hillsides of Lahaina and provide food for the community. Taro is a staple food crop. It was the most culturally important crop to Hawaiians and their main food source.
And a lot of people, you know, since the fire, you know, asking, you know, oh, you know, what was Malu'ulu, or, you know, what did it look like? And I just say the same thing. I say, I don't think it's what it necessarily looked like. I think it's what it felt like. Because when you go to Lahaina today and pre-fire, it's hot. You know, we grew up, when you go to the beach, you go to Lahaina because it's hot. But that's not what it was in the past because of those massive, you know, shaded groves of ulu.
From what Hokuau tells me, I can picture Lahaina 300 years ago as a shady place with a cool breeze and an abundance of food crops and flowing water. But that's such a distant picture from the Lahaina I know and grew up with, and a far cry from the burnt landscape of today. To get a better grasp on the contrast between the past and the present, Kumuhoku and I drive north from Lahaina Harbor up to the foothills of the West Maui Mountains to see Lahaina from above.
So from up here, we're a lot closer to the mountaintops.
That mountain up there is called Pa'upa'u.
So if we can imagine standing at the top of Pa'upa'u 300 years ago, what do you think it would have looked like below?
Well, at that time, Lahaina and all of Hawaii was still an agrarian society, which meant that you could see taro patches, you could see home lots. And I say lots because Hawaiian homes were kind of like a collection of buildings. So you would see those near the taro patches. And then there would be the trees and food giving trees would probably be what you see from up here all the way down to the shoreline.
And up here, the mountaintops are very green.
Yes.
300 years ago, but do you think that color would have extended down the mountainside?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, because we had agroforest, so a forest And we have Olelo Noel that tells us that where the trees go, the rain follows. And so they would have had much greener below.
And in between that time, in between 300 years ago and today, the Pioneer Mill came in, the Pioneer Plantation came in. Their legacy is contentious because the history of the mill was something up until the fire that some people celebrated. Can you explain why that history is contentious and why some people think of it positively and some people think of it negatively?
Well, in one way, Pioneer Mill hired people. Pioneer Mill took over the land for sugar and diverted water because of sugar to water the fields. So none of that water got down to the lower elevations, or very little. And so it was very difficult to continue raising taro, raising the traditional foods, because the water wasn't accessible. And in those days, they didn't know you could fight for the water. It just, these guys were the plantation owners. They were the rich guys. They had all the money. They had all the influence and all the resources.
Until the 19th century, Hawaii was ruled by the ali'i, or the monarchy, and they owned all of the land across the islands. During the reign of King Kamehameha III, he felt the pressure from the influx of foreigners and missionaries to change the way that Hawaii managed land. Then it would be more in line with places like the US and the UK. In a move to balance tradition and modernity, he changed ownership rights in 1848, and for the first time, this allowed non-royals to own land. Sugar companies took this opportunity to swoop in and buy up acres and acres. Plantations, like the Pioneer Mill, were extremely powerful. Each year, the Lahaina-based mill produced thousands of tons of raw sugar, which were exported to the U.S., and this helped to fortify political relationships between the Hawaiian Kingdom and the U.S. government. This influx of sugar plantations and private entities into Hawaii set in motion the fall of the Hawaiian monarchy. In January of 1893, U.S. President Grover Cleveland released the following statement. A small group of sugar and pineapple growing businessmen, aided by the American minister to Hawaii and backed by heavily armed U.S. soldiers and Marines, deposed Hawaii's queen. The group coerced Queen Liliuokalani off her throne and forced her to give up Hawaii under threat of war against the Hawaiian people. After the overthrow, Sanford Dole of the Dole Food Company family fortune became the temporary head of government. 3 years later, in 1896, the Hawaiian language was outlawed in the schools. Sugar is a thirsty crop, and the plantations diverted millions of gallons of water each day from the rivers of the West Maui Mountains to their sugarcane fields. Over the years of their operation above Lahaina, less and less water made it to the town. Moku'ula dried up, and the Pioneer Mill filled it in with dirt. The canals that ran through Lahaina disappeared and were covered in tarmac. And the ulu trees were burned, cut down, or they died in the oppressive heat. You're listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
Psst, bei AIDA gibt's jetzt erfrischende Last-Minute-Angebote. Zum Beispiel Kurzreisen zu den schönsten Städten Nordeuropas, schon ab 399 Euro. Perfekt für eine Auszeit vom Alltag. Jetzt buchen im Reisebüro oder auf aida.de.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
I'm riding through the burn zone with Akolu Lindsay in his flatbed truck on the way to his property where his house used to be. As we drive along, Akolu points out piles of rubble and tells me the shop or restaurant they used to be.
So were they all kind of like half standing originally and then this, it's all been pushed down by the trucks? It was just like this?
It was gone. Everything was rubble.
Akolu shows me around his property. He points out where the main house was. Now, only a pile of cinder blocks remain and some warped glass. I can see the footprint of where his detached cottage was and the faintest outline of a kayak. All that's left of it is a darker shade of ash in the shape of a boat.
To you, what's important is that this was your home. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, this is home, the feeling of home. And even in its devastation, it's still home here in Lahaina. My family home for generations, since the 1800s. So the senses that are missing nowadays for me is the sound of the ocean, the smell of the ocean, smell of the seaweed, the smell of ripe mango from our mango trees. The sound of coconuts falling, because we were one of the few people that had coconuts in their trees. We're a stone's throw away from the ocean. And the nice sandy beach. My grandfather used this ocean and my great-grandfather to feed their family.
For Akolu and his family, his home in Lahaina is sacred. It's a place where he can connect to his past and his Hawaiian culture. And he believes that in order for that relationship to be restored in the community, the water that was diverted years ago by the sugar plantations is one of the first things that needs to come back.
If you have water, you can be successful. But without that water, you're very challenged growing food crops. You need that water. And when you look at Mauna Kea Hawaii or the West Maui Mountains as one of the wettest spots in the world, and you have streams that are dry, but yet you have these structures that are in place that tells you there's a lot of water here. And we grew a lot of food here. In today's world, most of that water is diverted. Originally diverted for sugar. It's still being diverted for something.
When Akolu says that, he laughs. But it's a weighted word. Something. When the Pioneer Mill shut down 25 years ago in 1999... the ditch system they created to divert water for their sugar was sold with the land. To understand the present-day implications of this, Kumu Hoku and I met with Keomoku Kapu in a parking lot in the center of Lahaina. We're surrounded by burned houses, but there's also rebuilding going on.
We want to know, about your fight for water.
Oh. All I can say, liquor is for drinking and water is for fighting. And I don't drink, so I may as well fight.
Keomoku has been fighting his own battle against the land development company West Maui Land for 20 years. But the origins of his fight started over 170 years ago. Bear with me, because this story is complicated. In 1850, shortly after private ownership of land first became possible in Hawaii, the king introduced the Kuleana Act. This made it possible for Native Hawaiians to own the land they were cultivating food on forever. That meant the land would pass through the generations, and the aim of this law was to ensure that Hawaii would remain self-sustainable and food would always be abundant. But in the following years, the land that remained unclaimed by Kuleana title holders was sold or taken up by private entities. Keomoku's ancestral land was sold to the Pioneer Sugar Mill. When the mill shut down in 1999, they sold their acreage to West Maui Land, and the water irrigation ditches that the mill had installed were sold with it.
Well, they claim that the water, was theirs for the, because they're using all the diversion system pipe that was put in. Yeah, the delivery system.
In 2017, Keaomoku and his family won back the Kuleana right to 3.4 acres that West Maui Land had originally owned. But his fight didn't stop there. Written into the Kuleana Land Act is the provision that grants title holders the rights to all resources needed to cultivate the land, meaning you are owed all the water you need to grow food. But Keaomoku says that to this day, that need has not been met. He says companies like West Maui Land are taking too much of the water from their shared source. So much water that Keaomoku says sometimes his taps run dry. I asked West Maui Land for an interview and to reply to the comments Keaomoku made, but they did not respond or acknowledge my request. Keaomoku and other locals felt that if they wanted their fair share of the water, they needed the state to implement better legislation around water usage. So in 2018, they fought to introduce a system that would ensure millions of gallons of water stayed in the streams each day.
I think the most important thing that happened within the past 3 years was we asked for the in-stream flow standard to put water back in the river.
For the local community, this was a big win. These stream standards were established by the State Commission of Water Management to ensure there would always be enough water in the river for the people and the environment's needs. But some private companies have broken these regulations by taking too much of the water. In 2022, the Commission for Water Management fined a company $470,000 for, quote, drawing more water than it was allowed for more than 550 days since 2019. Since private ownership began in the 1850s in West Maui, water management has allowed private entities use of the majority of the water. Today, state data reveals that only 23% of water is managed by Maui County for public use.
The water that was for this town came from one source. It never come from the private sources, only came from the public.
In Lahaina, the fire hydrants are serviced by the public water system. And when the fire happened, Keaomoku says the fire hydrants ran out of water.
Soon as that top section went burned, when the fire department came down here for throw the fire hydrant, was dry. Because everything just depleted to nothing.
A state report detailing the timeline of the fire on the 8th of August listed the following in its conclusions. As homes and buildings burned, the water pipes failed and water flowed unrestricted. Pressure in the water main dropped to the point that there was no water coming from the hydrants in some parts of Lahaina. Keaomoku says that the wildfires drew attention to the disparity between public and private water use on West Maui, but that now the state is working with the local communities to better manage water use.
Right now, I think we got a chance, we finally got a chance to recognize the serious use of water, especially for this side. They will learn an important lesson when it comes to water. They managed it poorly. And now they want to make sure that they do it right this time. So now they're finally listening to us.
I asked the Commission of Water Management what is being done after the wildfires to expand public access to water in West Maui. And they replied,
we recognize that in many areas, including West Maui, with ongoing drought, climate change, and competing uses and needs, there may not be enough fresh water to meet all the needs. We do our best to be objective, fair, and balanced. However, CWRM's mission is to manage our water resources to ensure that there is adequate water to meet public trust uses, balanced with reasonable beneficial uses.
Hi, I'm here to see Ina.
Yeah, she'll come out.
Okay.
My name is Ina Kohler. I'm from Lahaina, and my husband and I are both firefighters at the Lahaina Fire Station.
I met Ina in the home she's temporarily staying in. Her family home was destroyed in the fire, and on the day we meet, the winds are ripping through the palm trees in her temporary backyard.
These are the Laniopoco winds. I mean, it's pretty funny because to be up here in this wind is like, oh, I didn't realize the sound of coconut trees pounding, thundering in the wind is like a trigger of like, what's wrong with me, you know?
I can only imagine. I mean, you were right in the middle. But was the winds on the 8th, was those, you know, up there with the strongest you've seen before?
Oh, yeah. Strongest I've ever experienced and seen, for sure.
I read in an interview you did previously that you talked about the water you guys used to fight the fire on that night. You know, you said there wasn't enough.
In the water, municipal water system is all potable water. So it's the hydrants are tied in with all the same water that goes to the house. You can drink out of the hydrants. It's all that same water from a well. My understanding is that it just didn't keep up. It couldn't keep up. There's no way. While we were fighting the fire, we kind of ran out. And we still had a slight amount of water coming in. We were about midway up the hill. So it's being gravity driven. We were probably some of the first to run out because we were up higher than a lot of others because we were right where it started. Yeah, we didn't have water. And there was no water anywhere else on this side in that system. If we would have had, at least had water, then we would have a chance. But yeah.
On August 12th, 2023, 4 days after the deadly wildfire, Hawaii's Governor Josh Green held a press conference where he made a statement about water management.
We do all that we can to fund our departments at the city and state level. One of the basic problems we have is water management. We have a great deal of difficulty having adequate water near structures and keeping land moist. It's extremely difficult in these days. That's one of the main reasons that we saw this fire. And so the things that we're working on, and we work on steadily at all times, is how we're actually going to manage our land.
But I think this story in Lahaina is no different than what we're finding all throughout Hawaii right now.
That's Hokuau Pellegrino, the local taro farmer and advocate for water rights we heard from earlier.
You know, for Lahaina, it was after Pioneer Sugar Mill closed, you know, you began to see the upland areas that once were forested that, you know, then was sugarcane, now homes. But the issue when it goes back to the natural resource, it's very limited in that area. And so what homes have been built in areas that were, you know, more of a drier, arid area, taking water from other watersheds, is really putting pressure on the larger cultural and environmental landscape. It's not a unique story. It's what's happening everywhere in Hawaii.
And really, what really makes Hawaii and those spaces special and important, when you change the landscape, you do away with all of that and you put houses, now you have golf course looking lawns and
pools
and homes and large homes. And, you know, when people go, oh, well, we can put our own well in and we don't have, it's the same water. It's putting the straw in a different place, but it's the same water. It does not help the issue.
According to the University of Hawaii, in the state, 4 out of 5 families cannot afford to buy a home. So these land developments that are sucking up large amounts of water don't directly benefit most local residents. In addition to housing developments and timeshares, we need to talk about tourism. It brings in money and employment, but it also diverts water to the many hotels, golf courses, and pools. I'm driving north out of Lahaina to Napili to meet with Naivi Teruya. He's a 19th-generation Hawaiian who was born and raised in Lahaina, and he survived the 2023 wildfires, but his home did not. To get to the home he's temporarily staying in, I need to drive through the resort town of Ka'anapali. Ka'anapali is just a few miles north of Lahaina, and it's where the majority of tourists stay, in hotels and condos, who visit Lahaina for the day.
When you drive from Lahaina to Ka'anapali, you pass a sign, a hand-painted sign on the side of the road that says, "Let Lahaina heal." And anyone who is staying in the hotels in Ka'anapali would have to see that sign.
I still have my clothes from that day, and I can still smell the ash on my shirt. Once in a while, I do kind of like just looking at it, and I smell it, and I'm like, man, I remember that. And I'm glad to be alive.
On the day of the fire, Naivi had an experience with tourists in Ka'anapali that he says really shocked him.
I'm glad I ran into the people I ran into that day because, you know, luckily I did run into one of my really good friends who was like a neighbor of mine, and we met up randomly and yeah, we just hugged and cried and just looked back behind us, and we looked at Lahaina just burning, and we just kept walking.
And you have this experience of walking past the hotels.
Yeah.
And how did that feel to walk past that whole area after what you'd just gotten out of?
Oh my God, the amount. It was... So my friend that I mentioned meeting up with, he snapped. He lost it. All the tourists were on their phones, filming what was going on with their Mai Tais in their hands, with their wristbands and their pool passes, and even the pool bar was, you know, looked like it just looked like a bar that were people talking and being loud and not even knowing what's going on. It sucked. It's the worst feeling. And then it's not even the people part that sucked. What sucked is like the things we see every day we don't really notice. Like how green the golf course is, how green the hotels are, how lush the landscaping is, how happy everyone is. And we're in town and we don't live like that. We don't experience life like that. That was kind of like a reminder to tell us, hey, the world hasn't changed. Like your world changed, but the world hasn't.
Tourism in Maui is a nuanced debate. According to data from the Hawaii Tourism Authority, 35% of the island's GDP is created by tourist industries, and about 15% of the population is employed in tourism. Between 200 and 300,000 tourists visit Maui every month. And tourists didn't divert the water, and they didn't cut down the ulu trees or fill in moku'ula. But the State Commission of Water Management gave me an example of a single hotel that uses up to 2 million gallons of water per day for their golf courses, resort landscaping, and gardens. And in this way, tourists do benefit from a mirage that has been built to serve them a slice of paradise.
You know, it was the Hawaiian culture that gave value to the world with this.
That's Akola Lindsay, head of Maui Cultural Lands and Lahaina resident who lost his family home in the fire.
This was our norm, and people from all over the world come here to experience it. But I think they're getting a false experience. And I saw that after the fires, we were housed in a hotel, as I'm swimming along the beach, getting some exercise, and I'm looking up going, wow, what a beautiful rainbow through those Kiawe trees. And you look closer, all you see is just high rises. I'm like, this is the false sense of Hawaii here. It is beautiful, but it's not the real Hawaii. And I realize that this here, where we're at, this is the real Hawaii. It's not the false one that we sell in advertisements that I saw down at the hotels. It's beautiful, but this is the real stuff right here.
How do you preserve culture and sustainability in a place like Lahaina when the economy depends on expanding development and diverting more water to serve tourists? When Kumuhoku and I were sitting in the historic site of Moku'ula, she shared her thoughts about this with me.
Today, if you look at the visitor industry and where things are going more and more, we want visitors that want to be a part of the place rather than just visit and just have fun and visit, but really get to know the place, the people, why it's important and why we love it so much. So if you look at visitor industry trends, you know, that is happening more and more so that it's not an extractive kind of visitor industry, but that it can be included in how we live.
So what are your hopes
for the future?
My hope for Lahaina, or for this Lahaina town, is when the rebuild begins, that the people who had homes and places here are able to return and once again begin to raise their families and to be a part of the town itself. And that when the businesses and tourism comes back, that it's thought to be a balance to the people that live here. I think we need to think about seriously what a better balance would be.
What Kumuhoku said about balance has been echoed in a lot of the conversations I've had with locals while being home. I wanted to know if this was being considered during plans for the restoration of Lahaina, so I spoke with Lahia Gionson, public affairs officer for the Hawaii Tourism Authority.
The rebuilding of Lahaina needs to be guided by and be led by the people of Lahaina. This is not the time to discuss how we best accommodate visitors in Lahaina. This is the time for the Lahaina community to discuss collectively the future of the area. Should there be questions that come up about tourism and how we might best reimagine tourism in the area, we are here. We are ready to share the expertise, the research that we have, and work side by side with community on that project. But at this time, we're not involved at that level.
What sort of energy do you pick up in, you know, Lahaina town now?
Sad. It's a sad energy. I mean, it's because we've lost so much as people in the community here. The stories were wiped out. The places your great-grandfather, grandmother used to play, where they met, the people they met throughout their lifetime, and the stories that are told to you through their life don't exist anymore. So it's a sad energy, but it's also hopeful for me personally, because, you know, I have hope that we will be resilient and try to build back on something that's better than what we had.
One of the many people working to keep Hawaiian culture at the center of the rebuild is U'ilani Kapu. Kumuhoku and I went to speak with her in the middle of the now destroyed Lahaina town on a noisy day when rebuilding works had just begun.
Aloha, here we are in Lahaina. Around us, you hear people trying to get their lives back in order after the fire. And sitting here with us this morning is U'ilani.
Aloha, Auntie Hoku.
Through her nonprofit organization called Na'aikane, U'ilani has established a kupuna council. They're a group of elder Hawaiians who are helping to inform companies working on the rebuild of the significant cultural areas in Lahaina.
So that is what Na'aikane is doing right now. We've established a kupuna council. We're taking them in and letting them tell us the story on how it should be done. We took one group in, and it was so funny because we started off crying together because just looking at the place was hard for them. Then they started, oh, I remember this. Remember when we used to run through, you know? So those things started coming out, and that's what we captured. But we wrote it down so we could share it with other people, especially with their own families, because it's important for their families to know what their kupuna remembered.
Many of the buildings are gone. Many of the historic sites are, you can't access them. So it's almost a blank slate now. So what do you think Lahaina needs now?
It needs time to breathe. When all of this debris and everything has been put aside, and it needs that time to breathe, and then it'll reveal itself. It'll reveal where the waters run. It'll reveal the way the winds blow.
When I think about all the people Kumuhoku and I spoke to when making this program, I keep returning to something Hokuau Pellegrino said. We were sitting on his family's kuleana land by a running river whose water he fought for over 20 years to be restored. He said, what went with the water went with the land, and what went with the land
went with the language. It's not one or the other. It's all of it. The people in Lahaina have watched as their town changed through the centuries. The loss of culture, the loss of water, the loss of land. They are all intertwined, and they are all things that local people want to come back through the restoration of Lahaina. And after the fires, there is a sense that now, real change might happen. In our final interview, Blossom Fatera, who works in Hawaiian cultural advocacy, told us, there is a chance now to listen to Kupuna voices, to our elders, to the community, to create a Lahaina that works for the many and not the few, and to restore the land not just for those who live here now, but for the generations to come.
What happened in Lahaina is a culmination of bad decisions in West Maui. I actually reached out to my kupuna. I said, "Kupuna, why did this happen?" And they simply said, "Because people got to know. People got to know what happened." And what they meant was, people got to know what we did to this place. Mm-hmm. It was the human hand that caused this disaster. And if we're not willing to listen and, you know, pick up that kuleana, this can happen again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Until we learn our lesson, or, you know, Lahaina will be no more.
I'm Pulama Kaufman. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.